Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everyone, this is Jessica Nevins and this is the Divine It Girl Radio Show, and I'm your host, and I said my name already, Jessica Nevins, and I'm joined by my beautiful co-host, Therese Tucker. Good morning, Therese.
Good morning.
And we are super excited. Oh, it's going awesome because we're super excited to bring you this show today, Invoking the Muse. We are launching our interview series today, and we are super excited to have a special guest for you today. We are joined by Julia Thornton. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Jessica. Hi, Therese. Lovely to be here. Very exciting.
Very excited to have you here. And Julia is just amazing. And see, with Invoking the Muse in this series here, we're talking with musicians and artists and writers, and there's a common thread here, and the common thread is really about, you know, working with the muse, working with creativity, and trusting. And we're really excited to jump into that today, and I just want to give you a little 411 on Julia because she's so amazing, and I just love her. So much. She's laughing.
Oh,
right now.
I love it too.
I know. So just, you just gotta, this is amazing. Julia started her musical path believing that her life would be mapped out quite differently to how things transpired. Isn't that funny how that happens?
Yep.
Julia began playing the piano at 9, graduated after persistent parental persuasion to the harp at 11. And accidentally fell into playing percussion at the Royal College of Music Junior Department. After many years of performing as a classical musician, life took one of its amazing turns, and she found herself touring with a British rock artist. Julia has performed worldwide, toured playing both harp and percussion, had a solo classical album, deal with EMI, trained with the top yoga teacher training school in the UK, from which she qualified in 2010, and has recently firmly planted her feet in sunny Santa Monica, California, as life continues to direct her course and steer her to where she needs to be. And right now, she is currently training in a cutting-edge healing modality, which embraces working with crystalline DNA. Welcome, Julia. Yay!
Yay! Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm very excited about this, as I love to talk, so we're going to have fun.
Yeah, we are. You'll fit right in, because Therese and I love to talk to you, and that's why the show is
Yes, I had a feeling from a little dip my toe in the water just the other morning. I was like, oh, yeah, this is going to be good. It's going to be like a fight to get a word in. And then now I know that you and I, Jessica, have both had coffee. It's going to be like, what, hey?
I know. I'm catching up to everybody. I've got my coffee right now. As you guys know, I'm like a creature of habit. So it's like I'm on the air, I'm like, I need coffee.
Yeah.
As I'm talking to you, I'm like, I can taste it if I don't have it. So I've got my nice hot cup of coffee here. It feels so good.
Oh, enjoy.
Doesn't it always?
Thank you. That first cup,
there's something magical about that first cup. It's like, oh, it's like very comforting.
It's a magic potion. It's a magic potion.
It is. It's a love thing. You wrap your fingers around the... Yeah. You wrap your fingers around the glass or the mug and savor it. Because I always have to ration myself. That's the other thing. I think my nervous system is just so sensitive that I can't drink it all day every day. I love the taste of coffee. If I could drink it all day, I would. But I'm like, I have to limit myself to about 2 a day. That's it. I'm such a weakling. I'm such a lightweight.
Sad, no, I'm the same.
True.
I think it has to do
there you
with
go.
If you already have a higher vibration of energy. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's not the vibration so much, but I'm already
a high energy
person.
Yeah, I think you have a point. If you have a higher you're at slightly higher vibrational level and you tend to have a well-tuned nervous system anyway, and, you know, performing will do that. So,
yeah, that's true.
But everybody's different. I mean, some performers... You know, they need much more stimulus than others to just kind of get themselves going, and some don't seem to. So maybe it is about the frequency that you're vibrating at. I don't know.
I can't.
Sure.
I can't.
Go Silence.
I have a feeling there's going to be a few train wrecks. So everyone's going to talk at once, and then suddenly there's going to be a big gap, and then what?
All good. All good.
Okay.
I was just saying that I tend to be naturally enthusiastic and excited anyway, so adding caffeine to that is like adding nitroglycerin in, so it's like a drop is good.
Well, this is the thing, like, you know, people can, I mean, my husband can tell when I've been on, when I've had coffee, because, and I'll be on the phone to someone else, and he'll just be laughing because he can tell that the person on the other end of the line cannot get a word in edgeways. And, you know, maybe 10 minutes before, we will have stopped at Starbucks or something. It's like, it's very obvious to him, but, you know, he finds it very amusing. So there you go. And I don't, I'm not really aware of it while it's happening, but, you know, it depends on the coffee, too. Like, you know, I could, again, I'm like a one-shot, two-shot girl, max. Like, we have a chap that I tour with when I'm on the road. And he will order a quad espresso, this guy. Quadruple. So that's four in one cup at one sitting. It's just mind-blowing to me. I mean, I'm kind of impressed but disgusted and horrified at the same time. Like, what is that doing to your heart, you know?
Oh, my
God. If I needed that much of a jump start in the morning, I mean, admittedly, maybe everyone's just piled off a tour bus and everyone's looking somewhat the worse for wear, but... That's worrying, really, to me. Everyone's got various stages of bus hair. We call it bus hair. You know, when you've been in your bunk all night.
Bus hair. Yes.
And your hair is just, like, completely crazy, and you haven't had a chance to look in a mirror. And... Yeah. So there
well,
you go.
I'm kind of breaking with protocol today, Therese, and you're going to be – I might shock and horrify our audience, but I am actually having green juice this morning.
Wow, so good.
Yeah, well, okay, see, the thing is, and Therese knows this, and some of our audience knows this too. Me and caffeine, we're just not good friends. I'm naturally pretty hyper, so it's like if you give me caffeine, I'm going to turn into the cat with the claws into the ceiling, like with big eyes, like totally amped, like, oh, my God, like, and I'll stay up like 24 hours. Like, it just...
It's not a good idea.
For me.
Well,
but
really
I like decaf.
Like
I love the taste. I love the taste of coffee, so I do decaf. But
yeah,
this morning
I decided to go
green juice. So I'm betraying the system.
You're very good. I can feel your halo from here. I can feel it. it's going. Oh, it's very angelic. So I hats off to you. I have had some green drink this morning. I had a Dr. Schultz special, but I followed it with I chased it with caffeine.
All the green drink
just to help it all move around my system faster. Yes, exactly. It just helps the goodness go around the blood system much more efficiently, and that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it's just like my brother, before he went off to school, he's in Boston, we used to go to Starbucks a lot together, and this one day he goes, I'm going to order a Dirty Oprah. I'm like, excuse
what?
Me?
I went to what?
What is that?
Like, what's a Dirty Oprah? And you know how Oprah has her line of teas in Starbucks now? Like, I can't remember what they're called. Tea Java or
the
something?
The chai tea.
Yes, the chai teas. So it's what it is it's a chai tea latte with a shot of espresso.
Oh, my God, that's
okay.
Sort of disgusting. Is it
he loves it.
He
swears by it. And so, you know, he started calling it a Dirty Oprah.
Yeah, that's a great name. It sounds like some weird cocktail.
It does. But
it is a weird cocktail.
If you order a dirty chai, they know exactly what you're talking about. And I was, like, blown away. I was like, wow, I learned something new today. That's pretty amazing.
Yep. As have I. I had never heard of a dirty chai or a dirty Oprah.
I know.
See, this is the thing. Is you never know what's going to happen on one of these shows with Therese and I. Like, the things that fly out of our mouth.
But...
Like, sometimes things fly out of our mouth that we're not even expecting. So,
I would love it to be the fly on the wall of the person who just logged in when Jess said, my brother had a dirty Oprah, and then be like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. Explain that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's so many other ways you could go with that.
So they're like, how is this invoking the muse? Dirty Oprah invoking the muse. How does that correlate? I don't understand.
That's how he would invoke the muse, you know? He's a cinematographer, so that's, you know, it's part of his process. Caffeine is part of his process.
That's part of his routine, yeah, exactly.
Yes.
He'll have one of those, and then it will stimulate all the neurons to just kick in, and he will have amazing ideas about where he's going to take his next amazing photograph.
Exactly.
There you go.
Which, you know, that's like the perfect segue because what we really want to start with here, that was beautiful.
So musical,
Julia, is we want to understand your creative process. You know, because today we're launching this, of course, so we're talking about invoking the muse. So what has that looked like for you in your life with your creativity? Because, you know, not only are you a musician and performer, but you're also a yoga teacher, too. So I'm sure, you know, being a yoga teacher, you're still in front of an audience, a much smaller one, but, you know, you're still leveraging some kind of work with the divine. So if you could just kind of walk us through your creative process and help us understand how you've invoked the muse and how you've worked with the muse. That'll give us an idea of, you know, how things expand for you.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely perfect that you mentioned the yoga side of things too, because, I mean, to answer the question directly and authentically, I would love to know what my creative process is as well. It kind of is, it's changed quite recently, and I've become much more conscious of it as my own sort of awareness has increased over the last couple of years. And my journey as a musician obviously started when I was very young, and I was just, you know, moving through life as you do as a 9, 10, 11-year-old, just probably being in the moment to a certain extent, but also I was naturally quite a fearful child. And, you know, landing in the classical world where I was going to have piano lessons and my teacher was very strict and very contained. And then within 18 months, I had auditioned for the junior department of the Royal College of Music, where I was going on the Saturday, and I was studying with many other sort of gifted, in inverted commas, children of similar ages. And we were in a system which celebrates, it's all about technique when you're young, because you're acquiring skills to learn how to play your instrument or instruments. So it's fascinating, because I would be so focused on the technical aspect of what I was doing, but yet I was instinctively a very emotional, heart-based player. And this was something that, as I look back now and I see how I would perform, because my heart teacher was a great believer in competitions. I think she thought that they were character building. And I think in some ways they are, but I also believe very much that some people are cut out for them and some people aren't. And there's just an aspect of competing which is just kind of goes against the grain, the heart center, big time. Because, you know, you get up on a stage, you may be performing and sharing something that you're doing, but you're very aware that there is a panel of adults in front of you who are there to judge, basically, what you are doing on multiple levels. And what I experienced and what my parents witnessed as well was that certain people would look on and they would be very involved in the technical aspect of how myself or my colleagues delivered a performance. And then there were other people who were much more drawn to how we delivered emotionally. You know, you've got notes on a page as a classical musician and you are interpreting the work of a composer. Mm-hmm. And it can be done in many different ways. Now, the beauty of my heart teacher was, there were many teachers that would produce impeccable students who all sounded the same. So they play the same repertoire in the same way. And, you know, if you're interpreting Mozart or Brahms or Beethoven, yeah, there's probably much more set way to do it because there's much more of a tradition. But a lot of the solo harp repertoire is very French Romantic. So it's early 1900s. Yeah, beautiful stuff. And so it goes along with people like Debussy and, you know, the French Impressionist painters, Debussy, Ravel, Sarti. So there's much more leeway for breathing in the music and musicality, for want of a better word. And my teacher really let her students do whatever it was they wanted to do. You know, if you really were messing up something, she would put a foot down, but mostly she'd just let you have your way with the music. I had a habit of not being able to read the notes accurately, but I had an amazing memory, so I would memorize the wrong notes, which I don't know if I've ever had an experience of doing that, but it's just mind-bogglingly hard to then unlearn them. And part of my training was that we would go to her and she would say, is the piece from memory yet? And you'd sit there and you'd say, yes, I've memorized it. And she'd take the music off the stand and she would have it in her lap and she'd say, play me the piece, perform the piece for me. And then there was a list in the back of your book. You had this book that she would write notes in every week. And the list at the back was called Your List of Pieces. And every time you memorized something and she approved of it, it would go in the back of the book. So you gradually work up this amazing repertoire, which was wonderful. But every now and then with me, she would look up and she'd say, that's great, Julia, but I think there's a little bit of original composition has sneaked in there. Misread some notes, and I had, so maybe that was the beginning of my creative process. Hey, I mean, I just kind of make stuff up, and I thought it sounded good, so, and I didn't know any different. I completely misread the notes. So, yeah, I think for me, it was all about technique for many, 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 many years. And it wasn't really, even though I knew, I think inherently and on a spirit level, I knew that I had a gift for pulling audiences in because I would want to give energetically to my audience. And audiences pick that up beautifully. You know what I'm talking about. When you see any kind of artist, whether it's whatever genre you're looking at, you have people who express themselves from their heart centers. And it doesn't have to be beautiful, heart, loving music. It can be rock music. It can be anything. But there's a difference when somebody is well and truly engaged on that level as to when it's just technical. And with classical, there's much more of a risk that you just get totally embedded in the technique of it all. So it wasn't until I was on the road with a British artist. And I remember just, I had notes in front of me that were written by the musical director, but I just started rewriting parts because a lot of people can't write that well for harp because it's very specific. And so we would be doing something like, you know, this artist I was working with was Brian Ferry, and he'd had a big hit many moons before with Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. So we would do this in the set, and I had this very basic part that the MD had written for me, which was lovely, but I basically began to embellish it. And I think I just, because I instinctively knew how the instrument sounded best, what registers were richer, and I instinctively as well knew how to use it as a rhythm instrument, because harp can be great like a rhythm guitar. It's very percussive. Technically, I think it belongs in the percussion section of a symphony orchestra, like a piano.
Yeah.
Because it's not bowed. You know, you don't bow the strings. You pluck them, and that sort of, the closest to that is hitting the strings, and a piano is obviously the hammers hit the strings. So that's where it tends to be on its own symphonically, but it's also, if you really had to put it in a section, it would be in the percussion section. So playing harp and percussion makes perfect sense to me. I don't think it makes sense to most people. I don't think
there
are...
No, it makes sense
to
me. I agree with that.
Cool.
And I agree with the piano being very percussive because I... And your husband was laughing at me a few years back when I was trying to learn guitar, and I'm like, I'm a guitar.
He was?
Yeah, he was laughing with me. You know how he's
oh, okay.
very sweet. So he's laughing with me.
Yes.
But
yes,
I told him,
I
said, I'm a total guitard. And he's like, no, you're not. You just need to practice. And it didn't come to me as easy as piano and drums came to me. Piano and drums were just like a quick, easy, like I just locked into place and went and ran with it. But I didn't have that experience with guitar. Guitar, and I love guitars, and I admire guitarists. I have a beautiful Gibson SG it's vintage, it's gorgeous. And I would love to play it. And I've tried so many times.
Sit and stare at it and stroke it fondly and say one day.
I stare at it lovingly, like, oh, I love you so much. I just wish I could play you, but I'm such a guitard. And I've really tried to, like, remove that mental block. Because, Therese, see, we talk about this a lot on our show, right, Therese? Like, removing our limits.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm laughing because I also have an acoustic guitar that sits here, and currently the only one who plays it is the baby who crawls up to it, bangs on it, and walks away.
Oh, yes. That's great.
Sorry for that. Yes.
Well,
but
I have two guitars sitting next to me right now.
Well,
I have an acoustic and an electric, and I have no intention of playing them whatsoever.
I'm surprised you don't have more than that. I remember, I think there's usually just a ton, isn't there?
Yeah, there are actually 1, 2, 3, 4 guitar cases in the corner as well, and I think they probably all have guitars in them, so there you go. But, you know, it's fine. And I'm waiting for my harp to get home because we did, our last show was in Rio. We did Rock in Rio with Rod.
Mm-hmm.
And we're waiting for the gear to get back, and they always slip it, ship it rather, the slowest possible. So I don't think it's due back till the 1st of November, so I'm missing my harp terribly. Even if she just sits in the corner and, you know, it's just that she's there, you know. It is a
mm-hmm.
girl, you know, they have to be really. I don't think harps look particularly masculine, so it is a she. They've got curves, you know, they've got hips and stuff. So.
And for all of you out there, Julia often gets mistaken for an angel because she plays the harp and she's blonde and she's very petite and pretty. So people are like, oh, it's an angel when she's up on stage.
It's true. But then what's nice is I now have the contrast with when I do, because, you know, I've been doing harp and percussion as a double act ever
mm-hmm.
since I started working with Brian Ferry. He was the one who sort of kind of encouraged me to do that. And it was really by default because I never intended to play percussion professionally. I always just considered myself, you know, again, just like classical training. This is the instrument that I consider my first instrument. I will be a harpist and I will go out into the world and play the harp. And, you know, life just doesn't work like that, which is why in my little bio, like I said, you know, life took one of its amazing turns because this is seriously... Everybody can say this. I know that everybody out there listening and everybody out there who's not listening can say that, you know, they've been just going along and doing what they thought they were meant to be doing. And then it's almost like some kind of something just hoodwinks them and they turn around and suddenly they're going in a whole other direction. And that's completely what happened to me. And suddenly somebody actually shoved a washboard in my hand. Because unbeknownst to most people, Brian Ferry had a massive hit with a song called Let's Get Together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a washboard all the way through that. It's quite low in the mix on the actual track.
Mm-hmm.
But we would do it live, and he would insist. And I was lucky that the drummer knew how to work a washboard and gave me a set of cymbals, which were far too big for my fingers because they were for his fingers. And he stuck. I don't know what you guys would call it. We have this stuff called blue tack in the UK, which you can,
mm-hmm.
is kind of like sticky, tacky, and it's blue, and you stick things to walls and stuff with it. And we put piles of that in the tops of these thimbles in the hope that my fingers would stick inside these oversized thimbles. And they put the washboard on a proper percussion stand, and I would play it in the gig, you know, and that was kind of the beginnings of... And gradually things got more. I was asked to play tambourines and bongos and all sorts of things. And it was utterly terrifying because I was going totally off-piste, like life does. And life was going, you're going this way now. And I was resistant because I was fearful.
Mm.
because, mm-hmm. you know, that's very much a classical, well, it was for me anyway. I think it was partly just my makeup. I was a very sensitive child, and I had this perspective that was gifted to me that was, I was coming from fear most of the time. So mm-hmm. just constantly being very critical of myself. And that's wonderful because that really can stand you in good stead for learning new skills later in life, but you've just got to get the balance right. You know,
yeah.
you can't just be never satisfied with what you do. Otherwise, you just, you know, you just beat yourself up at every corner and every opportunity when something is less than perfect. So, yeah, so it was a fascinating journey, and I've been doing it ever since, harp and percussion. And so, you know, there is the angelic aspect, but then when I get on a cowbell and I'm whacking the hell out of this thing, or I'm hitting a pair of toms and my hair's flying, and people are like, maybe she's not so angelic after all.
In your leopard print dress.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you see, I don't have a choice. That leopard.
Yeah,
everybody,
I know that's
girls,
part of what you have to wear for the gig. But I was.
Yeah.
I have a picture of you wearing yeah. that dress from when
yes,
I went
I
and saw you guys in Vegas back last January.
those dresses are not actually that uncomfortable, but they're not particularly forgiving. It's like, you know, you go if you're hungry and you go to catering and you have everything going and you have, you know, dessert and everything, and then you forget. The point is, we don't know what we're going to wear that night because Rod very much will decide literally like an hour before the show.
And
so
she's
we've
speaking
all
of Rod
ourselves.
Stewart, by the way. For everyone listening,
yes.
she's speaking of Rod Stewart. So.
We're on first name terms, so I never.
Yeah.
I bet you all knew that, didn't you? Yeah, you knew that. But yeah, so we will have all stuffed our faces with apple crumble or whatever. God knows what. You know, they always have like two or three desserts or puddings, you know. So there we are, stuffing our faces. And then the leopard dresses come around. We're like, oh, no. No, please, no. There's no hiding in the leopard print dresses. Yeah, but, you know.
So,
we're pros.
Julia, I have a question for you. Because I've been kind
Go
of, like,
it.
Mulling this over in the back of my head while you've been having this awesome chat. My question is, was there a marked moment that you can remember when you realized that Source or God or the universe, whatever you want to call it, was that moment you realized that the music that was coming through you, this creative ability, your ability to pick up a new instrument, was something that was coming through you rather than from you? Do you remember that moment?
Yeah, I've had quite more and more of them, the more sort of awake I've become. And that process has really only happened to me in, I suppose, it's been the last 4 or 5 years. So I would have moments where, for instance, I was given a wonderful opportunity by Source, obviously, and life itself, of kind of doing some improvisational work with a band that I formed in the UK. And this consisted of a rather disgruntled bass player who was just happened to be my ex-manager. Back in my record deal days, this guy was my manager. But he's also a very, very fine bass player. And he was disgruntled with working with a particular band and a particular guitarist. They rubbed each other up the wrong way. And he had this idea that, why don't we just invite Julia to come bring her harp and just do a gig with us and just see how it goes, you know. And him and the drummer became interested, I think. And the drummer is actually a wonderful producer. He's worked as part of a band in the UK called Trans Global Underground, who did a lot of very early world music mixed with beats and stuff. They were doing it in the late 80s and 90s. And these two basically approached me after we did this gig at this club in Ladbroke Grove in London and said, let's just go into a studio together and let's just play. Let's just have some fun. And this was my first experience. So I was kind of in my mid to late 30s. And it's my first experience of literally playing my instrument, because, you know, whenever I approached my instrument, it's to practice. I go to say, I'm going to go and do some practice, in inverted commas. That's the word I would use. But to just sit down and play with something I hadn't really done, it's just kind of desperately sad, actually, in some ways. But what a gift to suddenly be in a recording studio with this massive open live space. And the desk was in the live space. So we just had this wonderful rapport with the guy who was just basically hitting record on everything we did. And the process was lovely. I mean, the drummer, the stroke producer, had these wonderful samples and loops that he would put up and we would listen to. And then both him and the bass player would lay down a kind of groove, if you like just a sound, a platform. And I would play over this. And I had a bunch of guitar pedals that I was using. And I'm not very technologically minded at the best of times, but I'd worked out a basic kind of daisy chain to connect all these things up so that I could put my harp through various delays and loops.
That's super cool,
and kind of
by
sound
the way.
Effects. Yeah.
I've never heard of that before. That's awesome.
Well, it's something that I'm working on at the moment, actually. We'll get to that. Hopefully we'll squeeze that in at some point later on. But so I was just having fun messing around, and I'm a very rhythmical player, so it was really easy to play with delays. I can play with delays till the cows come home. I don't know if you guys use that expression here, but that just means I can do it endlessly.
We do.
Right. Okay, cool. Sorry, every time I might have them. Just maybe the odd translation issue with the UK-US thing. But so we just spent the whole day just having fun. And then the results were just reams and reams of stuff, which, interestingly, I listened to. And, of course, I had that experience of not really being able to remember what I'd done.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was all just coming out of me,
right.
Through me,
yeah.
Like you say. And it was just, it was fascinating and weird and liberating, incredibly freeing, all at the same time. And we loved playing together. I mean, eventually things disintegrated. We made 3 albums, but eventually things disintegrated because I was spending more and more time in the U.S. Once I got this gig with Rod Stewart, I was spending much of my time over here, and they couldn't continue, really, without me. They tried, but it was impossible without my presence. but yeah, you know, it was a really interesting time, which allowed me to really have fun for the first time. I mean, I always had a feeling when I was playing classical music that I could feel something in me. When I was moved by music, there was an energy and there was a vibration, and I would feel it in my core being, probably from. Then those of you who know anything about chakras, it was probably sort of third chakra, which is solar plexus, through heart chakra, through throat chakra. It was sort of in that region, and I would feel this buzzing and this surging of energy at moments during pieces that I love to play. And yeah, I'm aware of that now, but I always knew it was there. It was just knowing what to name it, and knowing how it manifested or where it came from. But I think that was really sorry.
No, that's
interrupt.
Okay. No,
do it.
I was just saying that because I was making kind of a mental list as you're talking, and one of the points that I think you know when source is working through you is that point that you had brought up about not really being able to remember. Because the brain or the mind, rather, the intelligence, the analytical part of our mind isn't really engaging.
The mental
like
body.
It does, right.
Yeah.
Like it does with technique. Technique is like, it's, you know, it's doing it's like doing math for the brain. Any kind of technique, whether it's musical or even like I'm an artist, so artistic technique, you know, you're thinking about it. Whereas when you're open, you've opened your channel and you're allowing that energy to move through you, that part of your brain sort of takes a little vacation.
Yep.
So if you're doing this work.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I remember I was, I think this may have been something I mentioned to you too the other day, but on that first tour that I did, I went out with Brian Ferry for about 6 years, and I met the most incredible guitarist who I worked with for many, many years after that too on different gigs, called Chris Spedding. He's kind of a legend in the guitar world. And we had this conversation one day on a tour bus where he was talking about technique, and he said technique is really should never be a means to an end in itself. It's really something that you need in order to do what you want to do with the music and the notes. And it was just such a simple way of explaining what technique is really for. And I'd never really consciously thought to look at it like that. And this idea that, you know, once you get the technique under your hands, and I mean, as a harpist, it's a very physical instrument. You physically wrap yourself around it. You have 7 pedals, which have 3 different positions. You have 47 strings. It's you're almost in battle with it whilst you're playing it. And once you've memorized a piece of music, I'm not kidding, it's like riding a galleon or something. Once you've mastered the actual note, especially if you're playing, say you're interpreting a piece that you've committed to memory, you're not thinking physically about what you're doing. Your mental body isn't engaged. But I've had moments in performance where I've been busy playing and I've been lost in other areas of my, other layers of my anatomy, more subtle layers. But then I've suddenly come back into my physical body with my mental body going, where's my left foot going now? What pedal am I on? Where am I depressing or pressing that pedal? And the moment you're thinking, you've just crashed. And you have what they call a memory block or a memory lapse, which is utterly terrifying when you're in the middle of a performance and there are people staring at you and you can't remember where to go next.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's liberating about being on a stage and just playing is, I think, for me now what I realize is the emptier my head is before I start to put my fingers on the strings, the better. The less there is in my head, the better. Because that way, it just, something always comes from nothing. Because it had to in the beginning. You know, this whole world came from, I mean, now we're getting into deep metaphysical quantum theories. That's just up my alley, you know. But, you know, it is really, you know, about that stuff. This stuff will always come from somewhere. And you hear this from other people, too. They say, like, I walked onto a public speaking stage. I had no idea what I was going to say. I opened my mouth, and the words just came to me.
Well, it's true. And so I'm also an actress, and I was just thinking about this, that there a standard nightmare of an actor is that you get on stage and you forget all of your lines. You get on stage and they just thrust you into the part and you have no idea what it is. And what I'm realizing is that nightmare stems from the analytical mind.
Yeah,
right.
Totally.
Because that's
yeah.
trying to control it. What happens when you get on stage and you're actually engaged in the moment is it flows to you. It
yeah.
flows to you. And just like you were talking about that when your mind comes back in, it's like, where's my foot now? That happens for dancers. It happens for actors, anybody who's on stage where you suddenly are aware or the mental... that analytical part of your mind, like, wakes up and is like, wait a second, where am I? That's what throws you off. That actually pulls you out of the moment because your energy, like, pulls inward, which is that awareness of what is the self doing versus that the energy going out, like, giving out to the audience and connecting.
It's like
it's
like the call dropping on a cell phone. You know, it's like
you're
there and all of a sudden the call drops and you're like, oh no.
You do. I think you
and then it comes
from...
back up, you know, and you get, you know, out of that dead cell zone or whatever. Because I've had that happen before where it's like my biggest fear was always forgetting choreography when I was, you know, on stage dancing. And as long as I let myself be in flow, everything was fine. It's just like you said, Therese. It's like as long as you are in a state of allowing, in a state of trusting that it's just going to flow through you, then the easier it is to to not have that drop off, to not have that disconnect, to not have your energy all suck back in, but to really just, for me, it was just being in a state of allowing, which I didn't really understand that at the time, but I'm looking at it as far as what I know now and looking at it in hindsight, is for me it was about feeling it. It was not necessarily
feeling it,
about,
yeah,
thinking it. It was more of a feeling than
anything else. As opposed to being, isn't it? Or
the
other way around. You know, when when you're in performance, there's that element of you've done the work, you've done the practice, now you're totally in the moment, moment to moment, and you're in a state of being. But, of course, when you come back into your body with your mental body just kind of going crazy, like you say, the call gets dropped and you lose that connection from source, and you can panic, and you can suddenly remember that there's an audience of however many people out there, and it just kind of goes. And yeah, it is, like you say, Therese, it's your worst nightmare as a performer. But, I mean, when I started working with Rod Stewart, what happened was there were basically bits in the show that they wanted me to do that they had mapped out, the MD, and there was a guitar solo that got replaced by a harp solo, and this is kind of my only solo moment really in the show, which is one of the songs in the acoustic set. And very interesting journey. That journey's only really been going on for the last sort of 2.5 years, but to suddenly have a moment, and it's pretty exposed. Everything suddenly stops, and I'm just by myself, and I have like 16 bars or something, and it's very strict harmonically. There are very definite chord changes. And I've just had, it's been such a process and such a journey to embrace, because to start with, I would plan things. And I'd be like, okay, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this. And then inevitably, by the grace of God, or whatever you want to call it, the plans would just vanish from my brain in the bars leading up to, because the violinist has a solo just before me, and I'd just get lost in her, listening to her, and I'd be like, oh, shit, what happens now? What do I do now? Where am I going now? And I just have to come in. And I got that thing of like, you know, I come off stage and people go, great solo tonight. And I'd go, I can't remember what I played. And the best ones are usually the ones that I couldn't remember what I did. And to this day, and now I know, and this is something my husband's brilliant at, and he's taught me, just try and have nothing in your head just before you come in. Nothing. Absolutely nada. Zilch. Absolutely nothing. It's just a void. And something will come from that void. And it will not be you. It will be whatever you want to call it. Source.
Mm-hmm.
That self with the capital S. You know, it will be that co-creation between you and your, you know, your creator. And something magical will happen. It's really cool.
And I love that because, you know, Therese and I, we talk about this quite a bit in the show. I think that we all, as humans, have a tendency of getting in our own way.
Oh,
and
totally.
Process you're talking about of just, like, letting go and clearing out your mind, that's actually, you're opening yourself up as a vessel to be used by the divine. So
that's
the divine
right.
can
and
flow through you. But if you
and
try
you're
and, like, we're talking
trust.
About, like, try and figure out, like, what foot is on the pedal, you know, what line do I have to say, or what turn do I have to do next, then you get in the way. That's
you
why
do,
it's, like,
and you, kind
you
of,
have to clear that slate before you even step out and do whatever it is you're going to do.
And I think when you try and fill in all the spaces, you don't leave room for the miraculous.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, like, you're just squeezing everything in. I mean, we're just, this is what we're taught with life, is just to plan everything. And as adults, you know, you to some extent, you need to do some planning ahead and into the future. But the more that those of us who are sort of in the middle of the ascension process, or whatever you want to call it, embrace this, the more we realize that we must trust more and more to be in a state of allowing and a state of flow, because moment to moment, everything will unfold as it's meant to.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's the way we need to look forwards to living our lives much more and more. But it is that being in that state of trust. And after a while, you do get enough this is the beauty of getting older, you get very clear signs and demonstrations that when you do trust, it totally pays off and you do get the support that you were looking for. You do get the sense of that the universe has your back, that things are for you, not against you, that it's not that there isn't enough, but there is plenty to go around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's very much my personal experiences more and more over the last few years. The more I've listened to my heart and gone with what will make me happy, the more the universe has just gone, great, yeah, we'll help you go in that direction. This is really where you need to be going. You need to be on this path. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's the art of allowing right there. leaving that space, and it's because it's a co-creative process. And, you know, we're talking about this in regards to artistry, really, or performance, but it goes across the board. You don't have mm-hmm. to be a musician or a dancer, an artist, actor, whatever, to have this experience. It's actually the process that we do everything with.
Yeah.
I know the other day I was trying to write a bio and I needed it to get more specific and my mental mind got blocked. It just was like it was not coming through. And I realized I am not utilizing part of my intelligence because our connection to spirit is part of our intelligence.
Absolutely.
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. And so I had to pull back and I stopped and I kind of looked up and I was talking to them and I'm like, this is in alignment with me. Help me write it. Make it easier. And mm-hmm. I got the feeling, because I'm an intuitive as well, so I got this bump. They were like, put your music on shuffle. So I was like, okay, I'm going to shuffle my music. What do you want to tell me? So I'm in the middle of writing and the first song that comes up is Unwritten by Natasha, what is it, Benningfield or something? But it's
Benningfield,
about,
yeah.
Yeah. It's about, you know, you're sitting there without the words, but they're right there. You just need to, like, allow them in. And I was just like, oh, my God. And then the words
That's,
came.
Yeah. That's God and having a little chuckle there, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. They have the best sense of humor. They truly do. And it's so funny
yeah.
because whenever I get surprised by that, the response I get back is, where do you think it came from? You're like, you guys think you invented humor, but it's, you know, it's been around
Absolutely.
Longer than we have.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
And I think that humor is definitely from spirit. When
mm-hmm.
people
oh, yeah.
have humor, it just feels, because it invokes something emotional. It's not really a mental reaction to humor. It's very much an emotional reaction. So it's definitely from a place other than from, you know, I mean, I always think that the mental body is very much about fear and lack. And you can feel, after a while, you get it down. You can feel when you just completely vacate your heart space and go up into your head. And it's usually
mm-hmm.
for me when I'm avoiding experiencing discomfort in my heart space, like a painful
mm-hmm.
emotion, which, of course, we're busy thinking that difficult emotions and difficult situations are against us, when in fact they're always gifts. They're always the universe trying
right.
to, or source trying to help us, give us what Mary Morrissey calls an opportunity, in inverted commas. You know, one of life's challenges is an opportunity. And she used a lovely phrase, which I like. See if I can remember it. But it was something to do with opportunities and challenges always arise at the very point, the very limit of our becoming. So whenever something challenges us, it's always at the point that we need to expand from. So we've
yes.
already got
mm-hmm.
to a certain point, but then
exactly.
open us up even more, we just get another, you know, we call
it's,
them...
It's the up level.
Passes
it
in
is.
The post.
It's,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is
the
up level right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've gone to the limit of where your comfort zone can take you.
And then you have to, you know, stretch out and take your foot a little one step further or dip your toe a little bit deeper and, yeah, expand again and again and again. I think Edwina talks about that in Spiritual Laws of Prosperity, doesn't she? Like, try and do something
yes.
regularly. Find something new that challenges you, that stretches your fears out, you know, that maybe does scare you a little bit. Try and find something to do that, you know, makes you a little bit uncomfortable. Takes you out of your comfort zone.
And being in the state of discomfort, what it does is it allows you to be completely present. Because when you have that sense of security, that comfort, you know, you can tend to go in autopilot. Because, like, then they're done that. I know what to do. And then that is when we have a tendency to disconnect from source a little bit, where we're not using that spiritual intelligence that we were talking about. Because we're like, I got this. You know, like, I don't need you to drive. I can drive this road. I've been on this road a few times. So you're disconnecting. When you go into that place of discomfort, you literally start talking again. You start talking to them like, I don't know what's happening. Help me here. If you're here, like, let me know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and the ego gets way too comfortable at times. And you know.
It does.
I mean, I think it thinks it's doing the right thing. I've said this before to my husband about the ego thinks it's protecting you from the unknown. But what it doesn't realize, bless it, is that it's actually keeping you from yourself and becoming, you know, more of yourself. It really does genuinely, I think, in most situations, think that it's saving. I mean, I definitely feel that about mine when I was coming from a very fear, lack, limitation place for many, many years. Although I could feel on some level that it was suffocating me, and I was sort of slowly, quietly dying. My ego was going, but you're okay. You know, you're okay. You're fine. You're still here. You're functioning. It's like, yeah, I'm functioning, but what, you know, to what end? To what good? It's true.
It's true.
And
we're
here to expand. Yeah, we're here to expand. And the thing is, you know, it's interesting that we got onto this part of it today. And this always happens with us. With Therese and I, we will come up with an idea for a show, and we'll get into the show, and we'll just allow it to expand. We always come in with, you know, that clean slate like you were talking about, and we just let, you know, whatever needs to come through, come through. Now, I had no idea we would get to this point in the conversation because yesterday for me was probably one of the hardest days I've had in maybe the last year. And
oh, wow.
What happened was, it's exactly what you two were just talking about a few minutes ago, is I've hit the up level. And this is a place I have never seen before. And, you know, of course I wanted to automatically go into fear, and I was like, no, wait, that's not going to serve me. That's only going to complicate the process. So I really have to let go here. And what it feels like is, it's like, you know how you go into, the best way I can think of describing this is a video game. So you're in the video game and you've played it before, right? And you've always gotten to a certain level. So you know how to get to that level. You can kind of do it on autopilot. You finally crack the level, right? And you get into the new level that you wanted to get to, like, all your life. And you get there and you're like, I've never seen a monster like that before. What do I do?
Exactly.
And you have to figure out how to navigate. And it really puts you in novice level. I feel like I'm like a newborn baby in like novice level right now. I'm just like, whoa.
Well, you're fully alert too. Now you're aware of everything that's around you.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what you're talking about, Therese, is it's like it almost, if you're open enough and you're not resisting, it forces you into complete present moment awareness where you have to take it moment by moment. You have to put each foot in front of the other, and you can't go too far. And you can't also
turn around
and look back. You have to trust. And so I am in a complete state of allowing and trusting right now, having no idea what's coming next. And knowing also, and learning and knowing, believing in myself enough to know that if there is a monster around the corner, like there is in a video game, there's always someone trying to destroy you.
Always.
one that comes around the corner, that I'll have what I need to move past that monster. But it's
not
a very
only that,
vulnerable space. It's like, whoa, like, whoa. I didn't know this is what it was going to look like. And there's no turning back. Like all the, you know, all the, there's no plan B. I chucked my plan B months ago. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to keep going.
And so what you have to do is you have to activate your connection.
Yeah.
Which is always
a
choice.
Completely what it is.
Yeah.
So, the amazing thing is it's a choice. So no matter how good you are at doing it, you still have to choose it every time.
Yep.
So
it's a moment-to-moment choice.
Right, exactly.
It
you could get on stage and choose to go be like, I got this, guys. I'm going to do this myself. And perform from that level. Or you could, you know, call in your higher self and activate that level. And it's always a choice. It's never going to be like one, you do it one time and it's done. It's every day we get to choose it.
That's right. I mean, it's like, I mean, I loved this about, I didn't know it at the time, but when I started doing my yoga teacher training, I was actually did it initially out of desperation because like many freelance musicians, I had such a lean period where I was just not working.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been on the road for many, many years with the same artist. And then when that stopped, I just, you know, it was difficult to find work again because people had just stopped calling me because they knew I was on the road with somebody. And after 6 years, that suddenly you're back and everybody's booking other harpists or whatever. So I had this very lean period and out of desperation to somehow generate some sort of income. And, of course, if I'd thought about it, I really would have said, right, you know, I should go into accounting or something that will actually make me some money, you know, or law or something. But, you know, me being me, I instinctively followed my curiosity and my heart, thank goodness, and went to my yoga teacher, who I'd known for many years, who had founded this amazing teacher training school. And, you know, we were taught through the process to do lesson plans. After a while of graduating, I just developed this real aversion to lesson planning. And so that now, more and more and more and more and more, I wing it. I'll end up in front of a class or a client on Skype, and I will just go with wherever the feeling takes me. Because invariably what would happen is I'd get in front of a class with a lesson plan and, you know, I'd say I'd got something really energetic to challenge them with, and they all looked half dead. I'm like, you know, we're dropping like flies with some lurgy that was going around. And I'd be like, okay, how's everyone feeling this evening? And they'd all just look at me like, please don't punish us. You know, and you quickly realize as well when you do a really good teacher training course in yoga that there's so much more to it than just the asana or the poses themselves. This stuff is deeply spiritual philosophy that's been around for thousands of years, and it's become severely misinterpreted and lost in the West. It's become all about the aesthetic, when really it is about what's going on, you know, moment to moment. You know, if you're in a posture and you're breathing, your breath is one of your best physical anchors to keep you in the moment. You know, it's used in Buddhist meditation, it's used in lots of different disciplines. And in yoga, in and out of asana during meditation, breath can only happen in the moment. Each inhale and exhale is unique, just like each heartbeat. So these were things that I began to recognize about studying this amazing science, if you like, and respecting the ability to go every moment into a state of allowing and choosing that, choosing to allow and choosing to look at my body in this pose moment to moment, or even if I was just sitting, meditating or breathing. It's just an incredibly eye-opening, and I didn't realize how much it was going to accompany me on my journey as a musician as well. It's like the two go so well together. They're both potentially deeply spiritual practices. I think like any profession in life, you can make it that if you come from that place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely does, 100%. Yeah.
And I can't remember if that was going anywhere. I'm having one of my moments, like I started talking
okay.
And I think... I was going somewhere with what Therese was saying, but...
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, when I do intuitive readings for people, and the keyword in what you were doing with your classes is intuitive, right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if I tried to plan it, I would fall flat on my butt trying to read somebody's energy and I also intuitively coach people. So if I come in with my idea of what it is they need to work on, I'm not present with them. And I kind of feel like the way that you're teaching from a state of presence. You're being in the moment with the room. And
it just feels so right to do that, you know?
It felt
wrong to just, I mean, to a certain extent with yoga, you have to do certain things to be safe. You have to, if there are certain poses you're going to teach, you've got to warm them up, you've got to do counter poses, which, you know, get rid of any possible contraindicative issues. But mostly these days, I don't teach very demanding physical work because I believe that you can really only go within yourself in the most simple postures, the ones that really allow you to just be in a total state of presence and feeling your body. From so many classes that you see, people are busy, you know, just directing their limbs from their mental point of view as to where they want them to go, and they're demanding of their body, and they're forcing rather than working intensively and intentionally. And you can just be on all fours, just, you know, extending and flexing your spine and be in a state of deep meditation. And that, to me, is what yoga is all about. And it's still beneficial on a physical level. In fact, probably more so because it's not only helping your spine, but it's allowing your nervous system to, you know, your sympathetic nervous system, which is your adrenals, to switch off and relax. Your breath is relaxing your organs, you know, your cardiac muscle, the heart muscle, all of the major workhorse organs, the smooth muscle organs like the liver and the kidneys. That's why I love yin yoga so much. You know, Jessica and I have that in common because it really opens the body up in a much more gentle, persuasive way. There's no pushing yourself into different positions. You simply stay in a pose for a number of minutes and you allow gravity and time to do all the work and obviously patience. And that's why it's not very particularly trendy, I think. You know, it's not because it requires a lot of stillness, a lot of introversion and a lot of presence. And you're not flying through an impressive sequence that looks amazing. You're just being, you know.
Which can be really difficult. I mean, it's a scary place for some people to go. It's just being...
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the other thing I think that makes it not so fashionable is that it's actually very challenging. I mean, if you're in a very demanding hip-opening pose and you're there for 5 minutes, you have to get the balance right between knowing where the hard edge of discomfort is and where there's a softer edge that you can actually sit without fidgeting and be present for what... sensation. I love the word sensation. My students, when I say that, they all know I mean pain. They all kind of grin at me as if to say, yeah, it bloody hurts. Thank you. We know. So, yes, interesting sensations that you might be experiencing, which, let's face it, we all know when we're in a hip opener, those sensations are pretty strong. But you've got to get the balance right. If you know, the only way to affect connective tissue in those particular, like, those really stubborn areas of the body is to hold pose. That connective tissue is like memory foam. It won't respond like muscle tissue, like an elastic band. It'll just, you know, ping backwards and forwards in and out of the pose. It will take time to form an indentation in that tissue. It's amazing stuff. I mean, I think this stuff is all connected to our spirituality, ultimately, like you know, what the components of connective tissue, the base substance, which they know is called ground substance, is what cells use to communicate between each other. And, you know, the body has a whole level of intelligence that, because we are busy talking and, you know, doing whatever we do, we've sort of lost touch with this possibly more primitive but maybe far more advanced system of communication that our body has self-cell. And I really think this stuff helps us in our health, you know, like meditation, slowing down our breathing, affecting the nervous system, affecting the heart rate. Some of these amazing yogis that can, you know, stand on one leg and sleep for a day, or bury themselves in the ground for 3 days and still be okay. I think they have some kind of secret way of doing this stuff, which isn't rocket science. I think we could all harness the stuff, but it takes discipline and practice. And
yeah, well, and I think it's actually, because I've been thinking about that myself, and I think it's about connecting into nature, like understanding things. You know, there's a certain type of understanding that we can't get with our mind. Literally have to turn it off.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking about these, like, Tibetan monks that go into caves, you know, and they're basically naked and have, I think, no food and water. And they're, like, in there in the cold, and they survive this. And I forget, it's, like, some crazy amount of time, and this is, like, some extremist Tibetan monk behavior. But what I realized that they are doing is they are activating the knowledge of hibernation is what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And they're slowing the heart rate right down.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they're doing certain things to conserve energy and organ function.
Exactly. They're controlling their core body temperature. This
yeah.
is all something that animals do when they hibernate. And it's like, oh, this information already exists in nature, and they're just tapping into it.
Yes, definitely. They have kind of rediscovered some kind of ability that I think is innate in all of us. It's like I think we all have the ability to heal. Some people are naturally drawn to healing more than others, but we all have a heart, and the heart energy will travel down the arms into the hands, and we all have the ability to touch someone and offer comfort through our hands and our skin. I mean, the skin is the sensory organ of the heart. So when we want to comfort, we instinctively reach out to give someone a hug or embrace them or touch their cheek. I don't think it's just people who are naturally empathic or come into their empathic abilities later in life, like sort of many of the people of our age. I think definitely more and more this is starting to happen. We start to realize that there are certain qualities that we're looking for that are not satisfied by simply achieving on certain material levels in life. There's something else, something that is lacking. And, you know, in yoga, they would look at that as, they call it maybe dharma, your dharma. What is your dharma? What is it you're here to do? And for most of us, more and more, I think there's this sense that we're here to help others. We're here to facilitate other people into these shifts and these changes that are taking place in the world and in our physical bodies. You know, this process of ascension that many of us are experiencing, moving from three dimensions to five and higher.
It's definitely
affecting us physically, emotionally. I think that's why many of us are finding that we're going through experiencing a lot of emotional pain and growth. Because, I mean, unfortunately, I think human beings do tend to have their steepest learning curves through pain.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us don't get to learn through joy. I don't know why, but, and some of us, illness has, you know, plays a part. I know for myself, I had a thyroid condition for many, many years, and I always believed that it was something that could be healed, even though doctors just said to me, this is, you know, you've inherited this from your mother. It's nothing. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just your lot in life, and you just take drugs and do this, and you'll be fine. And I never, ever settled for that. And I was lucky enough to experience healing, bizarrely, over the phone from, like, you know, thousands of miles away. And I don't really like the word healed, because I think it's so much more than that. I think it's integration. Because ultimately, I don't think any of us need fixing. We're completely whole, but we just haven't integrated everything that we need to. You know, we need to basically exercise that self-love constantly and acceptance of all aspects of ourselves. And that's what this did for me. It integrated something huge that was manifesting as this autoimmune thyroid condition. And when I look back, I realize, yeah, autoimmune, the body is physically turning on itself.
Yes.
physically turning against yourself. So it is a form of self-disgust, self-hate, a lack of self-acceptance, which was just, it's just me all over, you know, right from my classical training beginnings, you know, just constantly focusing on the tiniest technical details and never being good enough. So,
right,
you know, that reflected eventually in my physical health. So I think, I've lost this thread. I don't know where I came. Where did I come from? Where was I going? Can either of you help
right. me? Because this is just how the show works. Teresa and I have kind of given up on how things connect together. Just naturally just let it flow. And I think that we're on to something really magical here because, you know, I do a lot of energy work, and this goes back to the muse thing. And, you know, I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, Julia, especially since you're training in this new modality, which sounds very exciting. When I'm doing energy work, and I did a big energy clearing yesterday for a whole group of people, I have what I call a wealth circle every Wednesday, and I put people's names in there. And the intention is to increase their wealth consciousness and to also release any money blocks or any resistance to absolutely receiving the wealth that is available to them from the universe. And that can come, as we know, wealth can come in many different forms. This is the second time I've done this, and I did it last night, and before I even did it, I set the intention to be a divine channel and for these people and to hold this space for them and to really just let the energy come through me to these people. And it's really amazing because I can only, like we talked about earlier, I can only remember parts of it. I can't remember the whole thing. I can't remember exactly what I did. But there's a huge surrender in it. And actually, it changes me in the process as well, which is interesting.
Of course.
Now, And I'm sure that, you know, as you're doing this work with, you know, this crystalline healing, I'm sure you're experiencing that as well. And you know, Therese opens herself up as a channel for spirit all the time. So there's things that she's experiencing that are morphing and changing her as well. And I think that's part of what the muse does, is the muse not only expresses through you, but the muse in its invocation will change you. But you don't think about that part when it's going on, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit like the question and the answer, or the giving and the receiving, are both two sides of one equation. So, you know, I had to learn a few years ago that if I wanted a question answered by Source or the universe, I had to stop myself from trying to provide the answer. So I could ask the question, and this goes for really simple things. I mean, if anyone out there is listening, you may well have had this experience yourself, but if not, then you can try it. If you just lose something and you just can't put your hand on something that you had and you need by a certain time, and you've looked everywhere, and you just need to give up looking, and you need to say, okay, to speak to whatever you want to call the higher, you know, power, source, universe, God, and just say, look, listen, you up there, wherever you are, I lost this thing that what I need, and I need it in 2 days' time. That's the latest time by which I need it. I am going to hold off. And this was really hard for me because I was constantly in a state of fear and not trusting. I would be trying to preempt the answer the whole time. I'd be still looking secretly, and then one day I did this, and it was so simple. It was with an item of clothing, of all things. I just lost this bra, and I really, really needed it and wanted to find it before I had to close my suitcase and get on a plane. It was that simple. And I asked this question, like this had this book had told me to do, and I left. And also, I just kind of got sidetracked. I forgot about it. I completely let it go into the ether. And sure enough, I was flicking through a pile of clothes that I was due to pack, and it appeared literally on the day that I had to zip up my suitcase and leave the house. So, you know, this idea that, yeah, so this idea that you are busy with one side of, you, that's your side of the deal kind of thing. Then you allow the other side of the deal to come from that magical place, you know, that,
yeah,
that completely inexhaustible source.
That sounds a lot like the processes that Pam Grout offers in E Squared, which I love that book.
I don't know that book.
Oh my God, you got to read that book, E Squared,
okay,
by Pam Grout. But she has these ways of these exercises, and this is great from someone who's trying to get into alignment with spirit, and they're sort of stuck in that analytical state of mind, you know, where there's a lot of doubt and a lot of suspicion, like suspicious,
you know? And that's just that general lack of trust, I think, that things like doubt come from. That suspicion and doubt generally for me come from a lack of really feeling safe in the world, ultimately.
Yeah. So she asks them to approach it like the scientific process. And you actually give, like you did, you sort of give spirit a time limit. I mean, and it's still kind of vague. It's like 24, 48 hours, and obviously the more intense the need or the desire, the time limits aren't really going to work. But for these smaller things, it's amazing. But
it is
24
amazing,
hours,
yeah.
I'm going to just give you trust for 24 hours is really what you're doing. You're not putting a timer on them. You're sort of like giving yourself a timer where you're like, I am going to give a day to you or totally trust and see what happens.
So it's a little bit like when you tithe, you're demonstrating a faith and a trust in a higher power. And he's, I'm tithing this in faith to this source kind of thing. Yeah, I love that stuff. I think it's fascinating. And then, you know, the whole thing of giving and receiving, like this idea with you're busy focusing on giving to your clients. I guess that's what the muse comes back to in a way, that's just giving and receiving. And I think one of the things that blocks people is their inability to receive. People don't realize, but a lot of us are not good at the receiving side of things. And I think the empaths as well, people who have that longing to fulfill this facilitation of others, we have to remind ourselves that it's a two-way process and that when you teach, you get back. You always get gifts from your students. You get learning, and you have to allow, if someone gifts you in any other form, you have to be able to graciously receive whatever form that may be. It's not easy for most people because, of course, ultimately we're coming from a place where we don't believe that we're worthy or lovable or likable or we deserve it, I guess.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So we send a message out to the universe. Well, I'm not really, I don't really like myself. I don't really love myself. So perhaps you shouldn't give that to me. So the universe goes, okay, we won't then. We'll move on. And then, you know, when you start practicing self-acceptance, self-love, self-kindness, which you can do, I mean, you can do it on your yoga mat. You know, if you're in a class where a teacher is just push, and not allowing any space for breath, you can just roll up your mat and say, this isn't for me anymore. I'm going to move to a class where the teacher takes more time, has a much more heart-centered class and practice, and we move through spirit rather than through the mental body telling the physical body where to do and what to go. So that's an act of self-love. I mean, there's so many ways in which we can do this. We can, you know, put up a corner in the house where we have a little shrine, you know, update out-of-mode furniture or pictures that we really resonate for us or whatever. I mean, and also just simply taking 10, 15 minutes a day to meditate, you know, to sit with ourselves and develop a relationship with ourselves. That's so, I mean, I can't emphasize how important I am and how intrinsic to my well-being that has been. I've developed, because I've really got to know myself and I've got to experience myself. And it's a bumpy ride to start with because you realize, you start to feel everything. You start to realize what's wrong. I think this is scary for most people. One of the first things that happens when we start to wake up is we feel pain. It's one of the first things when you know you're waking up. You feel a lot of pain. And it's very disconcerting. This stuff often these meditations should come with some kind of health warning, because who's there to facilitate us at the end of, you know, for me, things generally don't come up during meditation. They'll come up afterwards during the day,
right,
or the next couple of days. And, you know, I will get a very clear message about something. It'll be an opportunity to experience some growth, you know, and it'll
right.
be a challenge of some sort. And when I first experienced this, it was pretty terrifying because I could feel my energy pain body. I could feel the fear state that I was in a lot of the time. You know, I could just physically feel this vibration that I wasn't used to dealing with because I'd lived in my head for a very, very long time because it was safe up there. You know, I could rationalize things. It didn't really work,
well,
but I could sort of do it.
And it totally makes sense. I mean, when we are growing, I have two children who are under the age of 5, and as they grow, you know, as their bones are expanding, they're feeling pain.
That's growing pain.
That, exactly. And so what you're talking about here is so perfect because we were talking, I think it was last week or maybe the week before, about success, you know, going back to success and how you know you're successful. And one of the things you know that is a marker is that you get a lot of negative feedback, which is akin to the pain of growth, but it's actually a good sign. So the pain, the irony is that those pains are a good sign. It's like you did it, you're doing it, it's happening. Now it's happening.
Yeah, and also almost, I think, when you're pioneering sort of light work, which I guess is an old-fashioned term for what, you know, we do, and I mean, many musicians are, you know, my boss, Rod Stewart, he's a light worker. He's just a different generation. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Jessica, you've seen him. He's amazing. He gives so much energy to an audience.
Yeah.
He's incredible,
yes,
and he can read a room within seconds. He's a very powerful human being.
He generates a complete capacity of love, which is connected with, you know, the whole light work aspect. There's a tremendous, almost like a love field is what I noticed.
Yeah. He gives... I'm sure, you know, people who can see and read energy would be able to see very clearly what he's like on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's partly, you know, personally, I work with quite a few artists, and he is one of the, if not the most authentic that I've worked with. And what you see on stage is pretty much what you get. That's who he is. He's not making any bones about it. He's just very open. And it's...
Mm-hmm.
Just so, I don't know how to describe it. It's just amazing to be on stage with someone like that when they're performing. Because you know when he's pissed off too. When he's not having a good time. It's very obvious. And I kind of love that too. He doesn't fake it. It's just glorious. It's kind of love. You've got to love that. You've got to love it. But I can't remember what
we
were talking about
the growing pains, you know, the pains
of
growth in all areas, and that it's actually a sign that you are successfully moving forward. You're moving through this. You're actually expanding. That pain is a natural part of the process, and we do so much to avoid it. Which is a whole other show right there.
So at some point I will gladly tell my story if you ever want to speak to me again after today.
Oh, we'll bring you back. You're not
about
getting away that quickly.
About my journey
we'll
with allopathic medicine and my illness. Because I think it's a fascinating story. Not everybody might, but it is. It's all about that. The way that modern medicine falls so short and does for more and more people realize that it's just, you know, we're just treating symptoms, which, you know, I always liken to, you know, you've got a light flashing on your dashboard in your car and you just basically stop and turn the light off. You don't even look under the bonnet of the car. So that, to me, is what allopathic medicine is. You know, we don't go very deep into what's behind the symptom. We just search for symptomatic relief. And if you've ever had any kind of chronic condition, you know that after a while, treating the symptom just becomes intolerable in itself. And it's almost like you know on some level that you really need to dig deeper. You feel it in your body and in your emotional state as well. And for me, the journey through healing my thyroid, I don't want to give too much away because the next installment will be gripping. But yeah, this whole thing of like, you know, realizing that there was something about my emotional reactiveness in the world that was contributing, if not making me sick. And I never would have believed it, you know, all those years ago. I think I was in my early 30s when I was first diagnosed with Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune thyroid condition. But, yeah, fascinating thing, this business of physical illness and how we deal with it and what it actually means.
Yeah, well, that is...
Because I think there is a prompt of growth in there for you.
Oh, totally. And
like you were saying, like allopathic medicine will try and get you to suppress that.
Yeah.
You actually decided to take like the more uncomfortable route, which has gotten you onto your path.
Totally.
But it probably didn't feel very good in the process. It was probably, you know, scary at points. It was probably emotional at points. Like Therese was saying, when things are falling away, which has been pretty much my experience for the last week, like just so many things are collapsing right now that I've just like, you know that card in the tarot, the Tower?
Oh, the Tower, yes, which is like total
chaos. That card always scares the crap out of me, right? And that's been pretty much...
It's kind of the chaos card, isn't it?
Yes, that's been the last week. So, and the culmination was yesterday, and I was sitting in the middle of my rubble saying, okay. So, you know, coming from an authentic place, you know, I could have glossed it over on the show today and been like, everything's fine, everything's great. But, you know, and I do generally take an enthusiastic, positive penchant toward life. However, there's some serious...
Well, there's something to be said for really owning...
Going down.
You know,
it's the growth.
Yeah.
It's part of the growth process, though. And that's
it's
at.
It's all good, right? It's all good.
Yeah.
I mean, and often, I mean, I would say to you, I'm so sorry for your week, but I also want to say, well, congratulations. You're obviously doing something right because when things fall apart like that, you know, it's
something
like getting a death card
coming.
In tarot.
Yeah, when you get the
death card, it doesn't mean you're going to get hit by a big red bus. Well, you wouldn't get hit by a big red bus in LA, but you would in London. You'd get hit by a big blue bus here, but, you know, you're not going to die. But something in your life is going to end. And, of course, when something ends, it always leaves the space for something new to come in its place. You know, it leaves space for you to create something or you to co-create something. And that's kind of exciting.
I'm feeling like a newborn baby. I really am starting to feel more and more like that. Like, I am trying to take my first step. So it's going to be interesting to see how things unfold, you know, how is it that we're already, like, this hour and a half just passed by a little too quickly, so I think that...
I know, I'm looking at the clock. Is it really 28 minutes past 11? Is that really the time?
Yes.
That's
so that means,
amazing.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up now, but, you know, I think that we've learned a lot here, and, you know, we've gone on, like, a really beautiful journey. Would you agree with that, Therese, that this is pretty typical for our show where we just kind of move in and out of things, so.
Right, exactly. Yep. That's how it rolls.
Yeah. Exactly.
I've loved this. It's been perfect. You know, I've done those interviews where it's all, like, very structured, like, you know, I said earlier, and this just totally... down my alley, up my alley, however you say it. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for having me. I hope you'll have me again. I hope I haven't
scared
off all your listeners.
And thank you for taking the time to be with us on the show today. It was such a pleasure to have you, and yes, we would love to have you back, and we'll figure that out with you very soon on how we can do that. And, yeah, everyone out there, have a fantastic week. This is Jessica Nevins for the Divine It Girl Radio Show. Love and sparkles to all. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.